Good evening, folks, and welcome to the March episode of Page Turner Podcast. With me, as always, is the lovely Rob Roy McCandless.
Thank you, Kari. I'm very excited to be here today.
I said I'd come up with a different word for you. Last month it was illustrious. This month it's lovely.
You're really working that thesaurus on me. I really appreciate that.
Well, Rob, who do we have with us?
Well, I am super, super excited, Kari, to introduce one of my heroes. So James P. Blaylock. James Blaylock is a Southern California writer whose short stories, novels, and collections have been published in translation around the world, along with, and this is when I get a little faint, along with Tim Powers at K.W. Jeter. He was one of the literary pioneers of my favorite genre, the steampunk movement. His novel Homunculus won the Philip K. Dick Memorial Award in 1985. His short story Paper Dragons won the World Fantasy Award in 1986, 13 Phantasms in 1997, and his story Unidentified Objects was nominated for an O. Henry Award in 1990. Now, despite his close association with steampunk, most of his work is contemporary, realistic fantasy set in Southern California, typified by the books The Last Coin, The Digging Leviathan, The Rainy Season, Winter Tides, All the Bells on Earth, and Knights of the Cornerstone. In all, he has published more than 30 novels and story collections, numerous articles and essays. Recent novels include Beneath Linden, River's Edge, and The Goblin Society. According to the Library Journal, Blaylock's evocative prose and studied pacing make him one of the most distinctive contributors to American magical realism. Mr. Blaylock, Jim, it's so good to have you on here.
Well, it's very good to be here. On here, I guess. Actually, I'm in California, but you guys probably are not.
No.
I'm in Southern California. Kari is in Canada.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Canada. No. That's a ways away.
Well, I'm in beautiful British Columbia, Canada, so I'm kind of just up the coast.
Yeah.
I'm in the cold part of the coast, though. I don't have all the lovely, sunshiny, warm weather. But we kind of are close, not really at all.
Yeah.
Like cousins.
Well,
cousins.
Yeah, exactly. I love British Columbia, actually.
Oh, you've been?
Yeah, several times. Even considered moving there at one time in our lives, actually.
Oh, wow. What stopped you?
The Vietnam War ended.
Oh.
I'm exaggerating. We went up to visit a couple of times and just really loved that atmosphere. And I have to say, Canadian people have a reputation for being very pleasant. And we've always found that to be true. And we thought, shoot, what a pleasant place. On the other hand, I don't know, things just didn't. That was when we were in our early 20s and we had no idea where we were going or what we were going to do. So it was sort of a passing fancy.
Well, it's certainly beautiful here. The whole Pacific Northwest it's very green. It's very lush. It's, you know, and Canada, right. I mean, you could have moved to Seattle too and gotten the same thing. What took you to California?
My wife and I were both born in California, and basically we've lived in California our entire lives, and Orange County for most of our lives. I was born in Long Beach, which is in L.A. County, 15 miles away, mm-hmm. And my wife was born in Encino, which is in L.A., basically, and aside from a year that we spent in Humboldt County in Northern California, which is also an exceptionally green and wonderful place. We just we're sort of born and bred in the Southern California wilderness, you know.
That's funny. I'm from Utah, but my dad was born in Long Beach. So that's very exciting. Yeah. For me, that's exciting.
I mean, not that it makes a lick of difference one way or another, but when was that?
1940.
1940?
Yeah.
Okay. So I came along 10 years later.
A little later. Yeah.
Yeah. And Long Beach was a wonderful place. Still is a wonderful place. But
yeah.
Yeah.
He's gone down there to look around. He's back in Southern California now. He lives just down the street from us now. And so His dad built some of the houses down in Long Beach, and so he's gone back to look for a few of those and see those, which was kind of fun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. So. It's a beautiful place. He probably saw a lot of changes, but...
Yeah, it's really different now.
So tell us then, like, growing up in California, tell us about young James Blaylock and why you decided to be a writer. Like, how did your life take that turn where you decided to, as my dad say, you know, pursue a dream? My dad likes to tell me that writing's not a real job, but you have to have a real job. It's like, okay.
Yeah, well, I actually, I'll give you the short version. When I was in second grade, I was in danger of failing because I couldn't read. And my mother took me in hand, and she got a book that was popular at the time among stalwart mothers. It was a thing called Why Johnny Can't Read, and she just sort of beat me with it every day after school. So I had to learn words and all this kind of stuff. And by the time I was in the third grade, I was reading sort of above my station, you might say. And I think I was 8 years old when I got a copy of the collected short stories of Mark Twain for a Christmas present. And I started reading those, and I started reading the books in my mother's library, which was moderately extensive. By the time I was 10, I was reading Steinbeck and Walter Scott, and not understanding a great deal of what I was reading, but very enthusiastic about it. And so I grew up a reader, and I had a bunch of smart, literate aunts who fed me books. And, you know, my mother took me to the library me and my sister to the library every Tuesday afternoon, and we'd come home with H.G. Wells and Jules Verne and Walter Farley books and whatever else. And so one thing kind of led to another. I think I started meddling with my own stories, trying to write like Steinbeck and other favorite writers when I was, 10. I wrote my first short story when I was 11, I'm guessing. And I just kept at it, but I had no idea that I was doing anything except the thing that I really loved to do by that time. When I was at the university, I took the only creative writing class on campus, because creative writing wasn't a thing back there as a university course of study. Yeah. And I had a really wonderful teacher who tried to convince me to mail things off, which I did, although they were all not nearly good enough to be published. And then I met Tim Powers, and he was obviously actively doing the same stuff. And one thing led to another. I think I mailed stories off until I was 25, and before my first story was published. And then I just, then, you know, there's nothing to persuade you more to write more than successfully publishing something, even if it's in a little hippie magazine, you know, made and put together in somebody's garage. And I don't know, by the time I started publishing in science fiction magazines when I was probably 26, and then my first novel was published by Delray Books in 1980. Actually, it was my second novel. My first novel became my third novel, The Digging Leviathan, a couple of years later. I had written an unsatisfactory version of The Digging Leviathan that was completely insane, basically. And it occurred to me that it would never be published unless somewhere down the line I figured out what I was doing. And then I had one of those light bulb moments and took out that first manuscript, looked at it, threw it away, and rewrote the whole thing, and it became The Digging Leviathan, which was my first, kind of a weird breakout book for me, for a variety of reasons. Didn't make any money, but it was a weird breakout book.
But it got you on the map.
It did.
It put you on the map.
it put me on the map, and in fact, it was there were a couple of Nebula Award judges in 1984 who were enthusiastic about it. Unfortunately, 1984 was when William Gibson wrote Neuromancer.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. I read that with a sinking feeling, you might say.
I can understand that.
Yeah, in fact, I have a fairly funny story. I think Lou Shiner recommended The Digging Leviathan to Gibson at that time.
Oh.
And I later, in a conversation with Bill Gibson, who I became friends with, he said he went into a bookstore in Vancouver, and he said, "Do you have this book, The Digging Leviathan, by James P. Blaylock?" And the proprietor said, "Well, yes, I do." And then kind of squinted at him and said, "Do you know if it's supposed to be funny?" Which... I thought, that might be a problem. You know? anyway, it's one of the funniest things I ever heard.
Well, you got him talking, so.
That's right.
So that's good. I am dying to know which of your books is your favorite, not which made the most money or which is the most popular, but which book is your favorite.
You know, that's a tough one. Mm. In certain ways, it might be The Digging Leviathan, just because it's so close to home. So much of who and what I was at the time went into that book, including a bunch of friends of mine. William Ashbless was sort of actively a part of Powers in my life at the time. I assume, I don't know if anybody knows who William Ashbliss is anymore, but a sort of imaginary poet who was actively publishing poetry at the time. And I needed a lunatic bearded poet in my book, and Powers needed one for the Anubis Gates. And so we both put William Ashbliss into our book, and both of the books were coming out from Ace Books. And the editor called me on the phone and said, "How come you've got the same character in your book that Powers has in his?" And I said, well, we just put him into everything. And so I'll change his name to something else. And she said, "No, I think it's the same guy." And I thought, well, why not? He's got probably access to a time machine somehow. he could be in Powers' book in 1810 and mine in 1955 at the same time. So it was simply a monumentally fun book to write, and then it kind of got a lot of good press, and it actually even ended up on David Pringle's Best 100 Fantasy Novels list, which I was very, very proud of.
Yeah.
That might be it. Maybe it's The Last Coin, which is also very actively reminiscent of the real Blaylock, to such an extent that my wife is still just a little bit doubtful about what elements of it are true and which are not. So that's fun. It's fun to write books about just the things you happen to be in love with at the time, and other people, you know, catch on. I don't know. It's hard to name my favorite. One of my favorites was The Rainy Season, a very different kind of book because it was set in the Santa Ana Mountains, and we had a cabin in the woods back there at the time, and so there are a lot of elements of that one. It's also set during an exceedingly wet winter, which is why it was called The Rainy Season, which we were essentially going through at the time I was writing the book. And I guess, my novels that are closest to home are probably my favorite. which isn't surprising. I have no idea which is my best. That I have no opinion of. But
you have your favorites. What are some of your favorite books that you haven't written?
You know, my dirty little secret, I suppose, is that I haven't really read science fiction aside from three or four different writers since about 1985.
Well, we won't judge you.
Okay, good.
We don't judge you. You're allowed to like other genres. What do you have any other favorites? Like, what have you?
Well, you know, I just got a call from a woman at the local library who was putting together a thing about people in Orange County, and she called to ask what my favorite novel was. Period. And I thought, okay, well, that's completely impossible. And I went round and round, and finally decided that my favorite that one of my five Desert Island books, maybe at the top of the list, would be The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham.
Yeah.
And Huckleberry Finn is in that top five.
So you go back to the classics from your childhood.
I kind of do.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Robert Louis Stevenson fan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think maybe I'm talking about books that had a huge influence on me when I read the books, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the ones that I will continue to reread over the course of my life. It's hard to say though. Very hard to say. I just, one of my favorite reading experiences entirely is the 20 or so volume set of, Patrick O'Brien's seafaring novels. One of which was made into a film called Master and Commander.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I tend to reread those from end to end. Every time I finish the last one, I pick up the first one and start again.
Oh, wow.
And I know this kind of makes me a candidate for a lunatic asylum, but I bet that I've read through the entire series 10 times. The only thing is, it's a book. The books I can pick up and start anywhere, and I know exactly where I am, obviously, by this time,
mm-hmm.
and that's nice. But I tend to read those before I go to bed every night, and they just, I guess it's not necessarily a good recommendation to say they put me to sleep.
But that's how you want to go for the night, right? That's where you want your head to be. I don't think you're crazy. I've done that with Harry Potter. Like I have read those seven books probably, well, at least once a year for the past almost 20 years. So,
well, you know, there you go. And I understand that, that too. It's full of those. I almost think of the Harry Potter characters as sort of being Dickensian in a way, sort of larger than life. They have
absolutely.
A comic element. And it's actually, I'm writing an essay about this at the moment, off and on, but it's almost as if they assume such a lifelikeness that in your imagination they're always at work doing what they're doing, you know, whether you're reading the book or not, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oftentimes, this is gonna sound crazy. When I'm faced in a situation, sometimes I'll be like, what would Harry do? In this situation, you know, and I think one of the things about those books and other books that I've read by J.K. Rowling is she gives you such an access into the protagonist's mind that you feel that you just know them from front to back. And so that's, I think, what makes you feel kind of close to the character. Right. Like I got that in Night Relics with the protagonist. And now, of course, I'm drawing a blank. What was his name?
His name was, I should pull the book down. Right now I'm drawing a blank also.
Sorry. Yeah, it was, I read it a while ago. Hang on, just, I've got it here.
In fact,
go ahead.
It starts out in a neighborhood right down the road where my wife and I were walking today. In fact, we walked past the house that he lived in Orange from pretty often.
I had a bad dream about the one when what's his name, Klein killed Pomeroy, and then he has the vision of the ghost coming at him with the. Oh, I don't want to ruin it for other people, but I had a nightmare about that when I finished the book.
It's Peter Travers. Peter Travers
Peter
is Matt
Travers.
Miller.
Yeah, Peter.
I was, Peter Travers. Thought, that's it.
Yeah, I thought you guys were going to get there ahead of me, but.
Sorry. Yeah, yeah. No, I just grabbed it and I was looking. I was at the end of the book, so I had to scroll back and see. But yeah, and so I got that same feeling when I read Night Relics, that I really sort of understood Peter and was afraid for him and worried for him. And I think that's what makes great fiction is that we consider these people. I mean, you know, our friends or whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, interestingly, I was just talking to my niece who lives up in Oregon over the weekend, and she mentioned that book. And speaking of Pomeroy, I believe that was he's a fairly terrible human being.
Horrible. Oh my God.
She said that he so completely freaked her out that she can't begin to look at the book anymore.
You know what? Like, I'm not even drinking water out of my tap. Of
yeah. Well, you
know, I won't.
The cabin out in the woods there was essentially the one we owned, except for I livened it up to make it seem a little bit more ghost-worthy. Gosh, I've got another good story about that book too, and I'm
let's hear
see
it.
If I can tell you without giving anything away. And this is going to sound very unlikely, but I don't know. Unlikely things happen all the time. I was writing that book, and there is a scene in it toward the end of the book that's a little bit weird. But he's in the house. And there's ghosty things going on, and something smashes through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say anything more about it than that. And the telephone rang, and it was raining cats and dogs here, too, because there's a huge storm going on in Southern California. The telephone rang, and it was my next-door neighbor calling to say that a branch off a big sycamore tree had just gone through our skylight in our cabin. And that the cabin was, you know, full of water, rainwater, and et cetera, et cetera. And I better come up as soon as I can and take care of the problem. And I just shut the computer down and gave it up for the evening, because the very idea that I was writing a scene in which something came through a roof
was playing out.
Yes, and that was very weird. I went up and told my wife about it, and she threatened never to let me write books again, but that didn't work out. That was that was a real close to home sort of a book. Also, lots of the books are close to home, though. All the Bells on Earth is one of my favorite of my own books, because a certain amount, because it's set in my neighborhood. In fact, it's almost claustrophobic. It's so entirely set in downtown Orange. The addresses are changed there's a bit in Night Relics in which, or excuse me, in All the Bells on Earth, in which there's a sort of a terrible rundown house where terrible things might have happened. And in fact, it's burned down in the book. And my son, interestingly, owns the house next door to that, which he bought 3 years ago, I suppose. So it's been since,
wow,
I don't know, 30 years after I wrote the book.
Wow.
Yeah, the house is still there, in fact, although I made it a creepy house. And actually, it's owned by a really jolly old guy named Mike, who's not at all into Satanism or anything like that. I'm glad he hasn't copped to the fact that I turned his house.
It was his house.
What if you could have any of your books turned into a movie, which one would it be? And who would you want to play the protagonist?
Boy, I don't know who I'd want to play the protagonist, but I guess I'm going to say The Last Coin.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be because none of my books have ever been nobody's ever made an effort to turn them into films, despite yapping from various Hollywood entities. Mm-hmm. That one's come as close as it could come, simply because I worked on a script. Real mistake, by the way, to get a novelist to write a script of his or her own books. It's just huge swaths of, you know, set directions. but there is a guy who at Sony Studios who produced a film called Natural Born Killers, starring Woody Harrelson.
Yeah.
And he was a fan of my books and said, gee, Last Coin would make a good movie. And I thought it would too. And so that went round and round and round for several years, and from one incarnation to another. And I guess that might be the one. The sidekick of my main character in there, I always had Gary Busey in mind.
Oh, yeah.
Today it's probably impossible, but back in those days, you know, he was at the height of his weirdness and was still acting.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, nothing. Go ahead.
So do you, when you do write a book, do you ever picture like an actor or somebody just like to base it off of, just for like description or mannerism or?
Yes. You know, sometimes I picture people after the fact, maybe even during the fact. In my steampunk books, one of the protagonists is Alice St. Ives, who's the wife of my early protagonist in those books. And I kind of have her pegged as looking like the woman who played Mary in Downton Abbey.
Okay.
Female lead.
Yes.
I always thought, well, shoot, I'll just call her on the phone and say, why don't you go ahead and, I don't know, yeah, it's ridiculous, but it's never going to happen. But she'd be pretty perfect. I picture somebody, but then I get involved in another book and another book, and I, you know, one thing leads to another.
Tell us a bit about your writing process. Do you, when you go sit down to write a book, how do you start? Do you do an outline? Do you do chapter outlines? Some people use index cards. What's your process?
You know, my process is, with a couple of exceptions, I get a glimmer of an idea for a story or a novel, maybe from setting, maybe from some, because I picture some strange thing. And I'll sit at my computer and have a sort of schizophrenic conversation with it, simply running whatever comes through my head into the computer.
Hmm.
And if it continues to evolve, I get page after page after page of single space notes, in which I actually have discussions with myself and call myself names for being an idiot and whatever it might have to be. And somewhere along the line, if it's working, I'll begin to picture various scenes as little films in my mind. And I mean absolutely picture them reeling out in my mind. And if those develop into enough stuff, I guess I would say, to yield 10 or 12 or 14 pages, then I start blocking them as scenes, and when I've got a good 150 pages worth of those, I begin to see where the novel could end up, and at that point, I usually write a synopsis of about 8 or 10 pages, just to see whether I actually can get out the other end of what I think I'm up to in terms of the story. And I got into that habit because it was back in the golden days of writing. I don't know why anybody would go into writing today, because it's kind of a dog-eat-dog process today. Back in the olden days, you could actually get money in the mail in advance on the basis of an 8-page outline in 2 chapters. imagine that happening today.
Yeah, can you, even King, you know? Yeah, if your name's King or Rawling, yeah, but the rest of us, no.
No, including me. You know, those days are gone. So I got into the habit of, if I was going to pitch a novel to Del Rey Books or Ace Books or whoever, I would write an 8 to 10 page synopsis written in the present tense that was kind of like a beat sheet if you're a screenwriter, I suppose. In you know, paragraphs, detailed synopsis so that it had some of the color of the novel without the style or the mm-hmm. voice. And if I could come up with a synopsis and I had 15 scenes in my mind, I'm generally speaking, I can start writing the book. And by the time I get, and as I write the book, let me back up. The process of writing the book generates the best stuff. So once I get going, if in fact it's taking the shape of a book, the ideas will come quite a bit more quickly. That the process of fixing to write the book often takes 6 months.
Hmm.
On the other hand, I have a book that's out making the rounds right now. I'm not sure where it'll end up. It's not a science fiction or a fantasy novel. It's actually a crime novel.
Hmm.
And it kind of came into my head fully blown, which had never happened before. And that the process of getting it ready to start probably took about a month. On the other hand, it went through a lot of alterations along the way, since I didn't know quite as much about it as I generally knew when I would know when I sat down to write a book, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. So you've...
Awesome. Like,
how did you find writing that you liked writing crime?
You know, I probably read more crime than I read anything else. Yeah. And also crime has to be almost, it's almost a given that it's tightly plotted.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think the best way to learn to plot, and I'm a big fan of plotted novels, mm-hmm. Is to read crime novels. You know, I suppose that there are ways that people plot, let's say, romance novels or something like
yeah.
that. And if I wanted to do that, I'd probably read tons of those too, you know. But
mm-hmm.
I don't have much romance in me. You know?
So what are some of your favorite crime novels?
What am I reading? I just finished up a book by Walter Mosley. I love his Los Angeles books.
Mm.
I'm reading a series by Barry Maitland, who is a British crime novelist, wrote most of his stuff in the books I'm writing now were written in the 1990s, 80s and 90s.
Okay.
They're real good. I like Michael Connelly. I'm a huge fan of James Lee Burke. I think he's one of the great American novelists.
Okay.
I don't know. There's a batch of them out there. I keep Tony Hillerman. I like Tony Hillerman. I like the whole Southwest, you know, Four Corners desert
yep.
thing that he does.
Right. Okay. I'm really into British crime right now. I just binge watched Broadchurch. Have you guys seen
good.
That? It was really good. It was really good. And I devoured the Robert Galbraith. Here we go back to J.K. Rowling. But I devoured all her crime novels that she wrote as Robert Galbraith. And if you're looking, if you want good crime, they're really good. Jim.
I actually have read those. She's really super. In fact, we got to the end of the most recent one, and then we've got to wait until next season or something like that to finish it up. It really irritates me. I always figure, I want to binge watch it, and then if I binge watch it and get to the very last, you know, bit, and it's not there. Anyway, she's super. You know what else is good is there's a British crime series on that's called Endeavor. That's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Broadchurch was good. Grantchester was very good.
Oh, okay.
I love any of the BBC mysteries.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just dynamite.
Me too. And Shetland's supposed to be pretty good too, but I haven't seen that one yet. I started watching another one called, I think it was just called Criminal UK. Uh-huh. And it was on Netflix, and it was just like interviews in a police interrogation room. And the first one had David Tennant from Broadchurch, and it was good. It was good. They're just like little shorts, though. They're like half an hour of like basically the police interrogating the supposed perp and just how they get to like the bottom of his crime. But it was pretty good. It had like one of the guys from Game of Thrones in there as well.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was pretty good. It was pretty good. Have you ever? Sorry. Go ahead.
No, nothing. Go.
Oh, Rob, are you still there, Rob? Or...
Rob, I'm just. Yeah. This was always going to be the problem, right, Kari? That I was just going to like. Who's Blaylock is talking? I just want to listen. Yeah. So, Kari and I were talking earlier, and so I'm a huge fan of your Langdon St. Ives, and I just devoured. I didn't actually realize that you had two more books out in with Langdon St. Ives. So I devoured River's Edge, and I had totally forgotten how you just draw me into the story, and I'm just like, oh, it's so great. And there's no sword fights or no gunplay, no explosions, like there's none of this. And I'm telling people like it's, you know, it's just these people. I don't know how to explain it to people. But what I wondered was, like, the places always seem pretty real to me. And Kari and I were talking about, like, have you ever gone to places either because you wrote about them or you wanted to write about them or something inspired you to go there? Anything like that?
Yeah. And in fact, we did at the World Fantasy Convention in Brighton several years ago. Boy, I think it's more years than I'm remembering right now. We actually added a couple of weeks onto to our stay and drove around Kent and went to Aylesford and Maidstone and over to the coast and just looked at everything that I had been writing about, desperately going through Flickr photos and old books, you know, trying to make sure that I got the ambiance correct. I was happy to find out that that I hadn't done too badly, but that was wonderful. In fact, I think after we went, I had written one of my Langdon St. Ives books, the Giant Octopus book, set on the South Downs in a lighthouse, and we managed to go over there and wander around, and I realized that it actually could have taken place as I had said it would take place. So yes, and of course, if anything is set in Southern California, I pretty much know the place before I start writing, simply because places tend to me anyway, to suggest the stories that ought to be told about that place.
Hmm. It's so funny. Cause I would say that you had been to those places in England, like Aylesford seems to like just live in my head now. Yeah. And that's funny that you hadn't been there until later.
Yeah. I think so too. They're Homunculus, which I wrote in, 85. It was published in 85, so I wrote it in 84. I had been to England once and had a certain understanding of the place, I suppose. But that was a lot of shooting from the hip. And same with the language. I don't know that I had that I was paying. I don't even know whether that's true. I wasn't as punctilious about making absolutely sure that a word that had to be British and useful in 1875 was in fact useful in 1875.
Right.
Today, when I write steampunk, I've got a big dictionary. A big English dictionary that I check everything out three times in, which makes it kind of stodgy.
If I could disagree with you, I think it works so well. It really draws me into that era And I'm always amazed because the words seem, they're unfamiliar, but at the same time, within your context, it just adds another layer, at least for me.
Yeah, I guess good. I'm happy because I want to get the languages as carefully correct as I can without trying to sound like Charles Dickens or somebody else who was writing, part of what inspires me are the Patrick O'Brien books, which actually take place in the late 18th century and early 19th century. Somehow or another, they sound absolutely authentic, whereas the experience of reading them is not the experience of reading, let's say, I don't know what, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're written for a contemporary audience, and yet they sound authentically 19th or early 19th century.
Yeah.
And that, I think when I used the word stodgy, I meant that the writing process itself took twice as long because there's so much that I need to look at hard to make sure that I'm getting it right.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yes.
I hope the result is not stodgy, but
no, that makes perfect sense in that. And when I pull myself out of the story long enough to think about, you know, the words and phrasing that you're using, and since I like love steampunk, but don't often see that level of detail in a lot of authors, it really brings that home, that if you're going to, you know, set your period piece in a period setting, you kind of should do the research so that it sounds like it enough that the audience gets that, you know, gets that grit of London or gets that grit of the out, you know, the outer shires area. Otherwise you're taken out of the story.
Yeah, I tend to agree entirely. The other thing I'll say is that that it's those elements, the 19th century, especially London, was such a weirdly pictorial, wild, sensory place that that's what attracts me to the place as a setting for novels and originally. And trying to capture that means paying careful attention to what it was in fact like.
Mm-hmm.
If I weren't doing that, I don't think I'd go to the work of writing steampunk at all.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know? It's because it's the language in the place that is so attractive to me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I sometimes wonder, not to cast back to what we were talking about earlier, but setting seems to be a really heavy, thoroughgoing part of my writing. I think for me, it's almost as vital as character. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I grew up as a writer reading Steinbeck, and his books about the Salinas Valley, which is a place I visited with my parents when I was a kid. And I became, I think, a writer who had the same, in a way, enthusiasm for place as Steinbeck had.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wondered whether or not it's that we're built with some sort of genetic compulsion to like this, that, or the other sort of literature, simply because of who we are, or whether we become the sort of writer who we have always enjoyed reading, and in a sense, change who we are in the process. I don't know if I'm making any sense here at all.
Absolutely. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. That's so anyway, my Victoriana, when I set out to write Homunculus and my very first steampunk short story, which is the thing called the Ape Box Affair, I had been reading Robert Louis Stevenson and I think especially Jekyll and Hyde, and I thought, gosh, I would like to write a book set in this world. A book that might have been written in 1875, let's say, if Blaylock had lived in 1875.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of ended up being Homunculus. And I so enjoyed it that, you know, I wrote steampunk for years. And then for a period of time, I did not write any steampunk. And then I started reading a collection of short stories, which I recommend to anybody who might be listening out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's by James Norman Hall, and it's called Dr. Dogbody's Leg. Mm-hmm. And it's a bunch of seafaring stories from right after the Napoleonic Wars. And our hero, Dr. Dogbody, sits around in a tavern with a bunch of old friends every evening, spinning out the story of how he lost his leg in the war. Only every night, it's a different story. And every once in a while, one of the characters will say, well, last night, didn't you tell us? And then he'll say, never mind that. And he'll go on with his story, you know. They're absolutely hilarious, and they're absolutely wonderful. And I read those books after, I think, I hadn't written any steampunk for a good 10 years. And then I thought, gosh, I missed this. And so I started writing it again. And I've been writing it since.
Since we're on steampunk, I am curious what you think of the current state of steampunk and steampunk authors.
You know, I have to say that I just, you know, Rob, your book was pretty much the only steampunk I've read from end to end in years. If K.W. Jeter wrote a book, I would read it. And he did about 10 years ago. Yeah. And I read whatever Tim Powers writes. Every once in a while, he goes back to, you know, historical England, yep. Whether it's steampunk or not, I don't know, but I gobble those up. But that's, you know, that's about it. So I haven't got any learned thing to say about the nature of steampunk. I do have a huge enthusiasm for the productions of various steampunk artists or whatever it might be. I love the stuff that's come out of it, just the art and the even music.
I
saw this was probably about 5 years ago, but there was an apartment in New York City offered for sale that was decorated in a steampunk style. And I thought, gosh, that's fascinating to me. I actually saw pictures of it, and it actually looked like a bunch of stuff they got at the dump. But I shouldn't complain, you know. If they thought it was steampunk, that's great, you know. So I love it. I'm not sure that the literature itself is as what do I want to say? It might be a little bit past. I don't find a lot of editors these days who have any idea of publishing steampunk.
Right.
Which is too bad, my mind.
Yeah.
I will almost without a doubt keep writing it because I so much enjoy writing it. And when you get to be my age, you might as well be doing it for kicks. you know.
So will there be more St. Ives then?
Well, there is a St. Ives that I've got kind of I think there will be, yes.
Okay, good.
In fact, when I wrote River's Edge, I had the idea that it was part of a three-part novel, a big three-part novel, that would include the Goblin Society and one other novel, short novel. Mm-hmm. And the three together would tell one large story. Mm-hmm. The first two have been published. The third one is sort of hanging fire on my computer. Mm. But if you've read the Goblin Society, you would know that there's a kind of a loose end that has nothing to do with. Yeah, it's kind of a loose end involving some very mysterious, nefarious books, which are still circulating in the world. And anyway, I have one of these days I should finish that story up and then see what's next for steampunk.
Excellent. Yeah. That's wonderful to hear.
If you could live in any book or any fictional world, any fictional land, any fixed planet, where would it be?
Wow. That's a good question. It can't be one of mine because I already live here.
Look, it can be. It can be, if you want it.
My Orange County books, or Southern California books, are so close to home that they only exist because I live here. So I don't think that's fair. I think
that's not a stretch.
Yeah. Boy, I don't know. Reading James Lee Burke once makes me want to live in the Louisiana bayous, but that probably is a real bad idea. I'm also convinced it's just terrible stuff happens there all the time. In fact, I just read an article about the proliferation of Nile crocodiles out that way.
Yeah.
Which is the naturalist in me, the sort of suppressed naturalist that I was going to be in my early days, is kind of attracted to the idea of you know, crocodiles in the backyard, but
yeah,
realistically, maybe that's not a good idea.
Or if
you've ever read, or if you read Nathan Ballingrud, who writes the, he wrote this short story collection about Louisiana and they were terrifying. So yeah, stay out of Louisiana.
I don't know. I'm so thoroughly at home in Southern California that I could imagine if the place of my dreams is probably French Polynesia, but I can't think of any books that were written there that I, you know, any fictional worlds there. I don't know. That's a hard one. I'll keep thinking about it.
That's okay. No, Rob, what about you? Where would you live?
Oh, that's going to be a hard one. Cause all the stories that are like are horrible places to live, right? You wouldn't want to live in, Westeros. You wouldn't want to live in Game of Thrones because it's just horrible. Like it's just brutal and bad. True. And you wouldn't necessarily want to live in Lord of the Rings. You wouldn't want to live in Middle Earth per se. Cause you know, there's a lot of Middle Earth.
That's what I was going to say.
I don't know. Like, it just, you know.
You wouldn't want to live in the Shire and, like, drink wines and eat potatoes?
Right. I guess you could say the Shire, and then you're off the hook, but the rest of the place is a mess, and you've got to be prepared for fighting all the time.
But it's actually, not a mess. Not since Frodo threw the ring into Mordor.
Well,
it's
that's
nice to know.
Yeah.
I have to say, the Shire came into my mind.
Yeah,
one of the places. I love that whole, I don't know, I don't smoke a pipe and never have, but that whole pipe smoking, cool little, it kind of reminds me of The Wind in the Willows in a way, with, you know, Mowgli's house and Badger's house and stuff like that could have been in the Shire. And in fact, I wouldn't hesitate to take a bet that, that Tolkien was in some sense inspired by The Wind in the Willows, and also that J.K. Rowling was in some sense inspired by Tolkien.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, she was. She said that in college all she did was wear eyeliner and read Lord of the Rings.
Okay, good. Because the Dementors surely seem to me to be connected to the Black Riders in some sense.
For sure.
The best way, I might say. I mean, it's one of those shoulders of giants things.
BC is like the Shire, where I live. I don't smoke a pipe either, but...
I had one character in my very first novel who smoked a pipe. my first book, The Elfin Ship, was utterly and completely inspired by The Hobbit, Huckleberry Finn, and The Wind in the Willows. And in fact, you can just see it there, and... it was my love of those books that made me pick up a pen and start writing it and simply write until I got to the end of the book. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, when I sent it off to the publisher, and this is kind of a fun story, I sent it off to Lester Del Rey at Del Rey Books, right around the time that The Sword of Shannara was just hitting the charts, you know. So it was a very nice publisher to be with. Tim was writing The Drawing of the Dark for them, and Phil Dick was writing The Transmigration of Timothy Archer for Judy Lynn Del Rey, if I'm not mistaken. And Phil actually wrote a very nice letter recommending my book. I sent it off to Lester Del Rey, who sent back a rejection letter saying, gee whiz, you're a very good writer, but you just don't plot worth a damn. And in fact, I just euphemized what he said. I bolderized it. And I thought, oh, gee whiz. And so I told Tim, I said, oh, I got a rejection letter from Lester Del Rey, and it said this. And he said, that's not a rejection letter. It's a test. Mm. So you have to write back and say, ask him if he will help you with the plot of your book. Mm-hmm. And I said, really, you can do that? Because I just assumed it was, you know, I was done. I was going to go off and, I don't know what, work for UPS for the rest of my life. And, so I sent a note back to Lester saying that, and immediately I got a response, and he said, oh, well, if you're willing to do some work, unlike most first writers, I'll buy your book. And wow. He just bought it. But then he sent a grueling 4-page letter detailing what's wrong with the way I plot and what was wrong with the book. It kind of made my hair stand on end. Mm-hmm. The only problem is he was entirely right.
so, brutal truth. Yeah, God, I hate brutal truth.
Yeah. Only, you know, it's sometimes it can have a happy ending because basically what he said is throw away the second half of the book and do it correctly. So I made me write an outline. I wrote the outline. I sent it back. He sent me a contract. Mm. I had 6 months to finish it up. And that was a whole lot of fun, because all of a sudden, I was engaged in the book again and actually taking my character through the paces that I should have taken him through. Basically halfway through the book, I had all my characters go to the moon, you know, and that's not if they didn't start out going to the moon, you probably should leave the moon for another book, you know?
That's a plot twist, eh? Everybody's now on the moon.
Yeah. And I really liked, you know, the Martian canal. So I moved the Martian canals to the moon. So there were platypuses and, you know, it was a disaster. Anyway,
No, that's a great, Elfinship is lovely. It's delicious. If you haven't read it, Kari, and you love Tolkien and all that stuff, yeah, it's delicious.
I'll pick it up. I feel like you're an animal lover, Jim.
I am.
Yeah.
I am. Consummate.
You said earlier if you had followed the path of being a naturalist, did you want to be like a naturalist then?
Well, yes, my goal was to be a marine biologist. Because I spent a great deal of my youth at the beach, being a slacker, basically. And I had the idea that if I could, and I also had a lot of aquaria. I was a real tropical fish nut. Mm-hmm. And I developed this idea when I was, 16, 17, 18 years old, that if I were a marine biologist, I could just live at the beach all the time. it turned out that when I went to school that I needed more math than I could deal with. And so that became kind of a hobby, I suppose. I had an aquarium with a very cool octopus in it and some other neat critters.
You have an octopus?
No, I did back in those days.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. So you had a saltwater tank. I have a tropical tank, like just a freshwater tank, but you had an octopus.
Yeah. Actually, I was enthusiastically a freshwater tropical fish hobbyist, but I think around the time I was 18 or 19, I set up a saltwater tank and got all the animals out of local tide pools. And, and they, you know, I was growing barnacles on the side of the tank, and all of the animals were doing very well, which meant that either they were consuming each other or, you know, but they, I didn't lose any of them. They, the problem was that to maintain a year-round aquarium of Pacific Coast tide pool critters, you pretty much need to refrigerate the water in the summer, especially if you're living in a house with no air conditioning.
Right.
And so I set it up in October, and then the following June I dismantled it, and I took all of the critters back to where I got them and let them go again. But that was my, that was both my most successful aquarium, just in terms of happy fish and healthy fish. It was also my most labor intensive, because I was, I would go regularly down to the beach carrying 5-gallon Sparklets bottles, which at the time were made of glass. I don't know if anybody remembers those days.
No.
And go out as far as I could in into the surf to fill the bottles, and I'd bring them home, and it was always haunting docks, for example, to see what was crawling up the side of the pilings, and it was really a blast. So that was what I wanted to do with my life, but it turned out that I wasn't going to make a success of it without a great deal of work, and so I decided to major in literature instead, which of course allows you just to make crap up and you get A's, and you know. I've worked that one now for the rest of my life. It's been great.
So then, okay, so this was one of the questions, Rob, that I wanted to ask James, which I think is funny. So if you could be any animal, then what would you be? What is Jim Blaylock the animal?
I'd like to be an octopus only because they have 9 brains, and that always seems thrilling. But on the other hand, they have a 3-year lifespan, even if they're old codgers, so that's not, you know.
I think the giant Pacific octopus out here, which I have a huge tattoo of, lives to be 5. So,
oh, okay. Well, there you go.
And you're orange.
We've got a desert tortoise that lives in the garage. Although he just came out in the last 2 days from his yearly winter sleep. And they live to be, you know, 80, 100 years old. That'd be nice, but they don't do anything. That's the problem. They eat, they sleep, you know.
Sleep.
I don't know. Maybe a orangutan.
What?
I'm going to say something also that's going to, this, people are just going to completely, this is going to wreck the podcast, but I will reveal.
You go ahead and wreck the podcast. It's okay.
Yeah.
I've always been a fan of possums.
Oh.
Because A, they look incredibly cool.
Yeah.
And B, they're like one of the most successful animals when it comes to adapting to city life. And there are many, many photos on the internet of possums dressed up in pajamas. And currently I was following one possum whose name, it was something like Pennywinkle or something. I believe it started with a P. Who was almost famous for his dapper appearances in pajamas, nightgowns of various sorts. So maybe a possum, except for people hate possums and they're, you know, made fun of because they have a long nose and a rat-like tail.
Yeah.
I actually really like possums. I have a lot of animals and I love animals. And possums are great for getting rid of ticks.
Oh, yeah.
They're helpful little creatures. They're actually so ugly, they're cute.
That's the way I look at it. And
right?
We have, the fences in Orange County where I live, there's redwood fences everywhere. And they're just at night, they're the high road for possums and raccoons and rats and other critters moving from house to house and stealing oranges and, you know, avocados and...
basically committing crime.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. That's James Blaylock would like to be an opossum.
In pajamas.
In pajamas.
Yeah. There you go. Maybe a nightcap, you know.
Yes.
Seen, so just one more animal thing. I could talk about animals for the next hour, but have you seen the My Octopus Teacher show?
You know, I have not seen it. I'm planning on seeing it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet either.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's supposed to be great. Well, what a pleasure this has been.
No doubt. This has been amazing. I think we could talk another hour. Yeah, I think we'd talk at least another hour with you without being bored at all.
I don't know. I'm going to start repeating myself. You know?
Oh, well, that'd be fine. That'd be fine.
But unfortunately, we do have to wrap it up for tonight.
Yes.
Our time slot. And Rob, you still there?
I'm still here. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Everybody just went silent all of a sudden.
It was one
I was just going to say that it's actually been a great deal of fun, and thanks for inviting me on.
Oh, it's been so great. I think I told Kari, you know, besides just fanboying over you, Jim, is that because we were trading emails back and forth, and I wanted to make certain that I could connect with you if something went wrong. Your phone number is now in my mobile phone.
I know.
Oh, okay.
And I told him, I was like, no texting him. And then Rob was like, you're not the boss of me. And I'm like, oh, here we go.
So no, it's been a real treat. This is a highlight. So
yeah, it's been a real treat. And thank you so much for coming on the show, Jim. You know, your books are hilarious and so are you. So it really shone through. Your humor really shone through, and it does in your writing as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks. It was a real privilege to have you on the show. And that's all for tonight, folks. For our March guest, Mr. James Blaylock. And thanks as always, Rob.
Thank you, Kari.
My lovely host. And as usual, thank you to our sponsor, Goodwin's Greenhouse Supply and Service. Until April, keep reading, folks.
Thank you and good night.
Good night.